Hello, thanks for downloading this podcast of The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the radio, too. Radio, you know, that thing with the crank in your emergency kit. Radio. Well, it sounds a bit like this. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Here's a question. Is friendly fire still friendly if it comes from a robot?
It is a cruel and bitter truth that in the fog of war generally, and our fight against terrorists specifically, mistakes, sometimes deadly mistakes, can occur.
As President Obama formally acknowledging that a U.S. drone strike killed American hostage Warren Weinstein and Italian hostage Giovanni Laporto last January, this cruel and bitter friendly fire incident happened at the hands of a drone strike. Drones, you will recall, are designed to be less detectable than regular aircraft, with capabilities to make multiple clandestine passes over a target before firing. And drones, because they are pilotless, are intended to put American personnel at less risk than traditional missile and bomb strikes. In 2013, though, Attorney General Eric Holder confirmed that four American citizens have died in drone strikes since President Obama took office in 2009. And there are more American deaths if you go back to 2002. Joining us is Andrew Coburn, author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins, and he's Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. Andrew, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, good to be with you.
So once again, this so-called surgical strike idea in the use of high-tech weapons like drones has proved to be not so surgical.
Well, that's right. And actually, you know, it's inevitable. I mean, President Obama sort of tried to make it sound like this was an aberration, you know, something in the fog of war and all that stuff. But actually, what people have to realize is, despite all the claims, this isn't really so precise. The intelligence, the whole premise of drones is they're sort of these super efficient, both intelligence gathering and targeting devices, really aren't that precise in all sorts of ways.
The question here is, you know, we popularize drones, we popularize these high-tech weapons, and yet they're not any more effective than anything else in the so-called war on terror if you're going to have this kind of an incident. And it really suggests that Al-Qaeda and ISIS can use hostages as almost bait for drones.
Well, yes, it does. I mean, the idea may well be occurring to them now. I mean, they had been, if they'd made it clear that the hostages were on the premises, perhaps, you know, one would like to think we wouldn't have targeted it. But yes, I mean, exactly. I mean, drones, the whole mystique of drones, which has been heavily sold on every side. I mean, both on the, you know, the administration and the military and the CIA have said, oh, you know, they're super precise and these wonderful technological miracles. And actually, you know, people who question the whole thing from a moral point of view also tend to invoke, you know, the power of technology, the power of surveillance technology. I mean, how we should all worry that, you know, Big Brother is watching us from the skies all the time. I mean, people should understand that what Big Brother is seeing most of the time is a pretty blurry image. In fact, I came across some documents when I was doing a Kill Chain that showed that actually under a lot of the conditions that they operate under most of the time, they enjoy 20/200 vision. As opposed to 20/20, 20/200, which is actually the legal definition of blindness for drivers in most states of the U.S.
Extraordinary. Now, kill chain is a precise term that refers to this ritual. You referred to morality a moment ago, this ritual of commands that is supposed to create some sort of careful authorization for the use of drones. But in fact, in practice, it can often be more of a fiction. Can you describe what kill chain actually means?
Well, kill chain is actually a term, you know, fairly common particularly in the Air Force. It's the whole procedure from when you decide to hit something or someone down to when you actually do it, all the sort of steps you go through. For example, in the 2003 invasion of Iraq, they spent put a lot of effort into trying to kill Saddam Hussein with precisely targeted strikes. One of the targeters complained to me afterwards. He said, well, you know, the kill chain, we couldn't get the kill chain down to below 40 minutes. because that was all the time it took to sort of, when you thought Saddam was, you know, having dinner at a particular restaurant, to getting the right weapon there, to getting the surveillance in place, to actually launching the weapon and then watching it explode. Of course, of all this, they blew away many hundreds of civilians and no Saddam. And that's one of the beauties of drones, allegedly, is that you can bring the kill chain down to seconds because the drone is flying around and then, whoops, there's, you know, the master terrorist or something, you know, that looks like might be the master terrorist, that you can fire off a missile right away. So the kill chain is theoretically seconds.
And while in theory, the advantage would be to have the kill chain to be short, if you don't know what it is you're hitting, the seconds that you have actually increases the level of confusion and possibly makes it more likely that you're going to take out hostages.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, hostages or, you know, or innocent, you know, just ordinary civilians. I mean, the wives, and children of whoever it is you're trying to kill. I mean, they say that they didn't kill anyone apart from four terrorists and two hostages in this particular strike we're discussing. I suppose we have to take their word for it, although so often their words turn out to be not the truth.
Finally, is the precision and these sort of collateral damage, you know, I use the term chillingly, civilian and hostage casualties, does it complicate the sort of political downside of these drones? In other words, will criticism escalate because there's a precision to this takeout? It's almost as though you're doing what ISIS does, being very precise in the way that you're killing. It's not just a missile strike that blows up a whole village and there happened to be a hostage there. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Very good point. You know, it makes it all extra creepy. For people, when they say, you know, we're going after a particular individual, then that requires presidential approval. If you don't know you're hitting, then the CIA can bang off a missile without having to ask anyone. If the precise act of assassination, of lethally targeting, or whatever euphemism they like to use, someone on the other side, and it has, as you say, you know, a huge political blowback.
Andrew Coburn is author of Kill Chain: The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins, and he's Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thank you, John.
So is it bad business or bad policy? Comcast and Time Warner apparently can't take the heat of intense regulatory scrutiny, some tough opposition from a handful of Democratic senators, and apparently after some decisive meetings with the Justice Department and the Federal Communications Commission, Comcast is walking away from its $45 billion master plan to take over Time Warner. With us is Katie Benner, columnist for Bloomberg View. Katie, welcome.
Hello.
So the net neutrality decision by the FCC makes the deal not worth doing or changes radically the Comcast strategy in that they're going to fight the FCC rather than try to join forces with Time Warner. I don't quite get it.
Sure. It's a little bit of both, actually. So you mentioned not worth doing. Let's table that because that comes in later. But what happened with net neutrality and the redefinition of what is high-speed internet? So they decided that high-speed internet had to finally truly be high speed, 25 megabits per second. And right now the average is 10. And the minute they redefined it as 25 megabits per second, suddenly there weren't very many competitors who could do that. The cable companies have always said in every region there's so much internet competition. You have the telephone companies, AT&T, Verizon, et cetera. So it's a very robust competitive market. But most of the telecom companies can't compete at that speed. And at that speed, suddenly the cable companies have this huge control, massive amounts of control. So then if you combine Comcast and Time Warner Cable, you create this internet connection mega monolithic entity, which is much scarier than cable, because right now, I don't know about you, I can't live without my internet connection, right? It's as important to me as water and electricity, and you don't want a monopoly there.
If anything happened, Katie, to your internet connection, we would stop talking at this exact moment.
Exactly.
So that's interesting. So actually, net neutrality makes the antitrust issues much bigger of a deal for companies like Comcast and Time Warner. So all of a sudden, the FCC and the Justice Department particularly are going to be harder on Comcast. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And then so for Comcast, the math is, can we continue to fight for this deal, knowing that the chances are going to be very slim, and then just as you said, it becomes a little bit easier to walk away. And keep in mind, there's no breakup fee here, so if they do walk away, they don't get in trouble, they don't have to pay a penalty.
So aside from some investment banks being very upset about all of this, not being able to do the deal, the merger didn't go through in the incredible shrinking traditional media market earlier this hour. Is Comcast possibly betting that there's really some fallout that's going to take place here, that maybe Time Warner will be broken up, that one of these companies is going to go away, that this competitive environment that you describe is actually going to result in some companies vanishing from the landscape?
You know, I think what you raised is a very interesting issue. Comcast is huge, and I think it will be just fine. The bigger issue, as you mentioned, is Time Warner Cable. What happens to that company? Because it's been in limbo for a while. There are people who wonder if Charter Communications, which originally wanted to buy Time Warner and which people thought would buy Time Warner at the end of last year, if they will sort of come back and make another bid for Time Warner Cable. That would be interesting. But at the end of the day, we've seen the cable business, again, like you mentioned, it's shrinking. It's becoming a harder business, a lower margin business. That always drives mergers and acquisitions activity. You always see deal making in that environment. So if not Comcast, I think we will eventually see more consolidation in this space.
You know, and the story of this has been, you know, the networks were huge once and the cable companies were tiny. Now the cable companies are huge. The networks are tiny. We could eventually be – our next conversation, Katie, could be Netflix buying Time Warner. Katie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Katie Benner is columnist for Bloomberg View. Later this hour, the challenges of making decisions for a loved one with dementia. We'll talk about a controversial legal case, but how have you made these kinds of decisions in your own family? White Plains, New York. It depends on the stage. When my mom could still articulate her wishes, we tried to comply. Once the disease progressed, we often made decisions for my mom, thinking about what we thought she would have wanted. Easton, Pennsylvania. Our dilemma was not in determining what my husband's grandmother wanted, but in not being able to give it to her. More than anything, she wanted to remain in her home, so it was heartbreaking to put Nani in a nursing facility after she became a danger to herself by unknowingly setting fires in her home. A live-in companion would have been ideal since she was otherwise active, engaged, and happy, but we couldn't afford the level of care that would have made all the difference in the world to her.
This is Holly Freeman, Portland, Oregon. I think most important are, number one, knowing the person and staying connected during progression of dementia or other cognitive problems. And number two, keeping lines of communication open with family and caregivers and medical providers. It can be really hard. These are very challenging conversations, but really important as more of us become caregivers for our elderly parents and family members.
My name is Todd Chisholm. I'm calling from Atlanta, Georgia, and I think dementia patients can't determine what they want for themselves. I think it's our job to determine what the best care for them is, because they're not where they can actually formulate and tell you what they want, but we are equipped to be able to tell what is best for their care.
More later this hour as we talk about a serious challenge where the legal authorities got involved in a family decision here on The Takeaway. If human slavery is your game, maybe you better head to Libya this week. Following the downfall of Muammar Gaddafi and the assassination of the U.S. ambassador in 2012, Libya has become a chaotic center of the human trade. Money for freedom on barely seaworthy boats taking refugees to Europe. This week, the death at sea of hundreds of migrants in the Mediterranean put added pressure on European leaders to find a solution to the crisis.
Saving lives, it's not only about rescuing people at sea. It is also about fighting smugglers and preventing illegal migration flows.
That's European Council President Donald Tusk speaking to reporters on Thursday. But the bird's eye view of diplomats does not adequately convey what Libya has now become. With footage from the Libyan Coast Guard, our friends at Vice News documented this trafficking and detention process in migrant prisons of Libya, Europe or die. Milene Larson is a Vice News correspondent who joins me now. Welcome, Milene.
Thank you.
So what do you see in the faces of people who are coming from this chaotic zone where trafficking is an active business?
When you're in Sicily, when a boat has just landed with people who have been rescued on these unseaworthy, overpacked boat crossing the deadly sea, if you look at people's eyes, you know, of course they've been rescued, there's a sense of relief, but there's just so much sadness. You can see that they've been through hell.
And Hassan, who's a Syrian migrant, who took this entire road, who spent $7,000, made it to Milan. Let's hear his voice, and I'll translate for you. He's telling a story that it sounds anything but relief.
يعني إذا ما متت بالصحراء هتموت بالحبس تبع ليبيا.
He's saying if you don't die in the desert, you'll die in prison in Libya. If you don't die in a Libyan prison, you'll find death at sea. I've tried this road, but I don't advise it to do it. Don't even think about it, Hassan says. So is he typical of the kind of fear that's in people's eyes as they arrive in these places of sanctuary?
They go through terrible things trying to reach Europe because there are no legal ways to get to Europe. You have to actually be on European soil in order to seek asylum. That means that people like Hassan are forced to essentially throw themselves in the hands of people smugglers, criminals, to make this journey. And there is absolutely nothing to guarantee their safety. And particularly people who take the route through Libya, usually many of them go from Sudan into Libya, and it's sort of chain of traffickers who operate and take them to different places. And it depends on what nationality you are, where you're from, the prices vary, the treatment varies. You throw yourself into this spiral of horror.
Well, the presence of foreign nationals on the street alerts everybody in Libya to try to take advantage. And so you've got people coming from an outlaw situation in places like Eritrea or a war zone situation like in Syria to a then chaotic situation in Libya. You spoke with, in the documentary, folks from UNHCR who say that people are ill-treated. There's no medical assistance. People are detained for months or even a year. You may get rearrested in Libya, and it all sort of speaks, and we can step back for a moment, to the lack of any coherent European policy for dealing with this. We're talking with Malin Larson, who's a Vice News correspondent. What are the European governments going to be able to do here?
Well, that is what they're all pulling their hair out to try to figure out. I mean, most of the accidents and deaths happen off the coast of Libya. So that means that even if the EU now boosts their own border security, which is the main priority of Europe, it won't necessarily mean that more lives are going to be saved. So we're going to see a summer of death. The UN sent out a press release the other day saying that they have 10 spiraling conflicts in the world where there is usually they only have to deal with one. Libya is just one of the many seemingly unsolvable situations that are deteriorating. Of course, if you're going to tackle this, you're going to have to look at tackling the reasons why people are leaving, which are conflicts that are unsolvable. You need to tackle people smuggling networks, but as long as you still have these conflicts and people have to leave, people are willing to risk their lives just for the chance to find safety, to find a place to live where they can actually build a life for themselves and for their families. Until you make that feasible in the countries of origin or transit, they're going to try to get to Europe. So it's a very, very complex issue to solve. And the biggest, most important, most urgent thing that the EU needs to tackle is the drownings, the many, many lives lost at sea. By this time last year in 2014, 56 people had died. Now, this year, we have 1,800 people. Those are horrifying numbers. That needs to be addressed.
Milin, the Vice News mission here is to really bring the human story to people who are hearing these numbers that you're describing. Do you think you've succeeded here? And personally, how has this affected you, seeing just the turmoil on both sides of the Mediterranean?
I mean, when I started reporting on this, you know, you hear these stories on the news, and until you see the reality of it, until you meet the people going through it, you don't get how inhumane, how urgent, and how big this problem is. It's, to me, one of the biggest tragedies of modern history, when you have 50 million people who are displaced around the world. Millions of people are waiting to try to get to Europe. And it's a desperate situation, and they're willing to risk their lives. To me, personally, reporting on this, you'd think, who would be crazy enough to go on these boats and put their kids on these boats when it's so dangerous? And they are fully aware of this. They say, I am saving up to take the death boat to Europe. And you ask them, but why? Why would you do that when you know that you could die? And the answer I've gotten in so many situations has been something along the lines of, well, if I stay here, I'm dead anyway. Or if I stay here, I die a little bit every day. If we go to Europe, we have a chance.
Malene Larson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Malene Larson is a Vice News correspondent who narrated the Migrant Prisons of Libya episode of the Vice News series, Europe or Die. To see the full episode, visit thetakeaway.org. So we're at halftime here at The Takeaway. You want to stick around for the second half, of course. A reminder, we are on Twitter at The Takeaway. Please do follow us there. And you can follow me at Jay Hockenberry. I'll answer your tweets. What you're listening to is really only made possible by those who contribute to public radio. If you do, thank you. If you don't, please think about giving whatever you can to your local public radio station. They need it, and you'll feel good about being part of a community that values stories like this. It's Friday. We want you to dig deep on the internet, but we want you to find quality stuff, which is why we have Sean Ramaswamy, host of Sideshow, a Studio 360 podcast about art you don't see in museums that you can find online or elsewhere. Sean.
Hi.
Our Friday Five. Let's start with number one.
Amy Schumer. Amy Schumer wins TV this week. Her show Inside Amy Schumer came back. Got a million views the first episode. She walks out of the red carpet, and she was right behind Kanye West and Kim Kardashian, and she just ate it on the red carpet in front of them for no reason and shocked everyone. And she wins the internet, where she uploaded like three of her finest sketches from her first episode. One of them is about aging out as a woman in Hollywood, and it co-stars Tina Fey, Patricia Arquette, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and it's real funny.
Well, is there anything you can do to delay it?
I mean, you can try, but it only makes it worse. Like those Real Housewives. They try to look young, but then they end up looking like a purse that melted in a car accident.
Yeah.
They look like when a kid draws a face on its hand.
But what about men? Like, who tells men when it's their last day?
Clooney. They're talking about Clooney. It's wonderful, and the whole show, the first episode of the new season is amazing.
Can you top that, number two?
Two.
This illustrator, Dan Hipp, posted to Twitter on Monday a three-panel comic illustration of basically his reaction to the new Star Wars teaser. Mm-hmm. And in the first panel, it's him as an adult on his laptop. In the second panel, it's the shot of Han Solo, like a grown-up, an older Harrison Ford, and an ageless Chewbacca in that scene at the end of the trailer where they say,
yep.
Chewie, we're home, he says to Chewie. And then the third panel, it's just him as like a little boy smiling ear to ear. It's really beautiful.
I remember where I was when the first movie came out. It is like a time machine to see those trailers. That
totally.
Is absolutely true. Number three.
Three.
YouTube celebrated its 10th anniversary this week, and to celebrate it, they just simply pointed to the first video ever uploaded to YouTube.
All right, so here we are, one of the elephants. Cool thing about these guys is that they have really, really, really long fronts, and that's cool. And that's pretty much all there is to say.
So they chose elephants because they were worried that smaller animals wouldn't read on YouTube.
I don't know if they chose anything. It's got 19 million views. It's obviously an unremarkable video, but that's what makes it remarkable.
10-year anniversary,
mm-hmm.
an epic, an eon in internet time.
Totally. Little did he know.
Number four.
Four.
Number four, the best Vine I've ever seen. You got to see it at thetakeaway.org, but it's 6 seconds, as they all are. It's a guy playing a little bit of guitar for his golden retriever, and then his golden retriever takes his hand and says, stop playing, but it's beautiful. The dog.
So the dog shuts him down.
Paw is just like, shut up, don't play any Sam Smith right now. And it's hypnotic. You'll need to watch it 20 times when you watch it.
Because he wants a dog treat. Number five.
Because he hates Sam Smith, like we all do. Number five.
Five.
Rihanna dropped a new song this week, and the internet loved it. I'd rather be smoking weed whenever we breathe, every time you kiss me. Don't say that you miss me. Just come get me. So it's called James Joint, and yeah. She posted it in celebration of 420, which was this week, of course.
Yeah, my 13-year-old told me about that.
The best part is she posted it on 421. Presumably because she was too busy celebrating and forgot.
Yeah.
Like because she was right.
Sean Ramos Aran, host of Sideshow, Studio 360 podcast about the kind of art you don't see in museums, but we get him on Friday. Thanks, Sean.
Thanks, John.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So this is just straight from the opening paragraph of a New York Times story. I'm just going to read it to you. You probably saw it this week. An Iowa jury on Wednesday found Henry Rahans not guilty of charges that he sexually abused his wife, an Alzheimer's patient, by having sex with her in a nursing home after nursing home staff members told him she was cognitively unable to give consent. Only about a billion questions in that paragraph. Here to walk us through it is Dr. Tia Powell, director of the Montefiore Einstein Center for Bioethics here in New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
So how, first of all, how present is this issue of consent? Let's get the marriage out of it for a moment, regarding sexuality with Alzheimer's patients.
One of the interesting things about this story is that it's news at all. This is not a new issue. There's nothing about being cognitively impaired that makes people not be lonely, not want human companionship, and not sometimes want sexual intimacy. I would be amazed if there's a nursing home in which this has not come up.
So the staff members telling the defendant in this case, who was found not guilty, that his own wife was unable to give consent, do you think that was an inappropriate intervention into a family issue, even though it is a medical facility?
It's hard to say in the individual case because I didn't obviously examine
right,
Mrs.
Sure.
Rahans. I don't know her. Certainly there can be abuse of vulnerable people. Certainly there can be rape in marriage, absolutely. That it happened here, I have no idea. There are absolutely people with cognitive impairments, dementia and other ones, who certainly can take pleasure from sexual intimacy. So I don't know what the basis is on which this evaluation was made. There's certainly no standard consensus among experts that this is how you evaluate somebody's capacity to make this particular decision, and this is the basis on which we decided that she lacked that capacity.
In terms of couples who are dealing with Alzheimer's, where does sexuality fit in terms of – and let's, again, get an institution out of it for the moment – where does that fit in terms – I mean, how are couples advised, all right, this is going to happen and here's how it's going to affect your sexuality? How are they advised? How is sexuality either an appropriate, help in keeping couples together or a complication?
I imagine that couples are not advised.
Much at all.
Exactly.
Really?
Exactly.
So this is just a gray area.
Well, it's a gray area. I think it's also a gap in our discussions and our advice about what happens with dementia. So I think stigma comes into play here a lot. I think a lot of people imagine that elders generally and people with impairments do not and probably should not have sex. So that's sort of our presumption. What that's based on, I don't know. There's no data to suggest that that's true. And frankly, people with dementia are as variable as people. Some may enjoy sexual intimacy. Some might not, the same as everybody else.
In this gray area, legally speaking, and as an ethicist, again, we're not trying to make you into a lawyer here, but does the law look at a case like this or attempt to in the state of Iowa the same as like date rape?
I don't know what they were looking
at. Yeah. Boy,
certainly, if you're in your home, nobody is hanging over your bed with a flashlight,
right.
I hope, and trying to decide whether or not there's appropriate consent when sex is going forward, whether people have an impairment of one kind or another, cognitive or otherwise, or not. So if you're at your home, we hope that your intimacy is in fact preserved and your privacy as well. Whether or not other people have a right to impose their judgment on what your intimate behaviors are, well, that's a really tough question. But certainly at home, people who are very ill, are dying, are free to do what they want.
Mm-hmm. So let's take intimacy out of it here for a moment.
Okay.
In terms of presumed consent among families when there is a loved one who is sinking into dementia, what have we worked out? I mean, what kinds of things have we worked out in terms of consent? Financial issues, that sort of thing. I guess proxies would be something that's obvious right on the front.
Absolutely. So for things that don't embarrass us, we have a much better roadmap.
Right. Yeah. So good. The good Americans.
Exactly. Right. Our puritanical instincts,
yeah, exactly,
you know, rising up
right
here.
Yeah.
So I think for medical decisions, if you're too ill to make your own decisions, we have a structure. We have a process for that. So, you know, we assess you. We say, listen, we think you need this treatment, but you're not really able to assess the risks and benefits. You're too sick, either medically too sick or cognitively impaired. So we're going to take that decision away from you, and we're going to assign it to your next of kin. So we're going to get somebody else to step in for you. And the same sometimes happens with financial decisions. So if we decided that was true about sexual intimacy, and by the way, there's no consensus on this whatsoever, the decision would probably go to your next of kin. Well, that's really tricky if that's your spouse. If there's some indication that there's abuse, it might be that that is not the right person to make that decision. It might go to somebody else. But unless there's some indication for abuse, I would have that person, the next of kin, make that decision.
And the idea that the institution is deciding up front who is cognitively able to give consent and not is something that the jury apparently had some issue with here in the Iowa case. But again, we don't know the specifics. Here's a comment from our Facebook page that just came in. Amy Rinella Taylor says, I'm both a nurse and a law student. I've been following this case closely. The issues of consent, sexuality, and dementing illnesses are all very complicated and require a careful individual analysis. In this particular case, there were several factors that were not adequately accounted for. The first and most difficult for people to wrap their minds around is the fact that once dementia progresses to a certain point, and again, this is our Facebook comment speaking, the person is no longer the person they used to be, so their past behavior, desires, needs, and wants are largely irrelevant. What do you think of that comment?
I don't agree, actually. I think bioethics has done some things well. I don't think this is one of them. The notion that you're not the person that you were, I find troubling. Actually, we should assume that you're in there. We all change over time. But you are still you, and unless there's some indication that you don't honor the things you used to honor, I would support your choices and preferences.
Well, then just to take Amy's point here, okay, she says that Mrs. Rahans perhaps wasn't herself. Is the couple still the couple?
I think they are, and I think unless there's some indication of abuse, I would let them do what they think is right.
Well, Tia Powell, thanks so much. Very interesting conversation.
Thanks.
Tia Powell is director of the Montefiore Einstein Center for Bioethics, talking about consent in cognitively impaired cases, referring specifically to a case in Iowa where someone was found not guilty of charges that he sexually abused his wife, an Alzheimer's patient, by having sex with her in a nursing home after staff members told him she was cognitively unable to give consent. We'd love to know what you think about all this. 877-8-MY-TAKE. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.